Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another episode. And today it is the 50th episode of the Thinking Basketball Podcast. And for that, I wanted to do something fun, something special. It seemed, given the corona break that we are on, the way things are going on in the outside world these days where there's no sports, it would be fitting to go back to the very first episode that launched this podcast in 2018 around the top scorers ever. And that podcast, for those who listen to it, and thank you, by the way, if you've been listening since the beginning, 50 episodes in, really, you all make this possible, the growth of this possible. So the idea was, in that episode, I had played with and debuted this idea of a scoring value metric that attempted to balance the value of volume and efficiency. We often think of scores as, well, is this guy like a 25-point-per-game score? Is he a 32-point-per-game score? And then within that context, how efficiently is he scoring his points? And there's of course, way more to it that I've discussed before that we've all talked about and we'll get to in this episode. But in that case, it was really about trying to look at this question of scoring and scoring numbers through a different lens. And so I constructed a list heavily based on that idea and that metric. Today is going to be a revisiting of that and something a little more nuanced, something a little more advanced. I'm going to attempt to use a new version of that, to use some new concepts, and really blend the data with the context that the players played in to think about, if we had to only choose guys based on their scoring prowess, who would we want? What would that list look like? In other words, who created the most value, or even the most, you know, championship equity in the playoffs or in a playoff-type setting by virtue of their scoring? That's the question we're asking today. And so to do that, of course, we have to dive under the hood and ask, what do we even mean when we talk about a player's scoring? When we say, you know, someone's great at scoring, what does that encompass? This might seem trivial, but it's not. It's actually the opposite for me. As I said in that very first episode, the idea of decoupling scoring from playmaking or other elements of offense is actually pretty tricky. We can't really do it perfectly. The beauty of basketball is these things go together. If the defense sits too hard on your scoring, or they react or throw extra defenders, you want to move the basketball to the soft spot and punish them for doing that. On the flip side, if they overload everyone else, you have to be able to take your man in isolation or punish the defense with some threat of scoring somehow. So we will try to decouple them, and I'll define here in a second how I view this problem. But this is an off-season podcast, if you will. This is a fun, sort of updating of the first episode. And it's not something that I think we should put too much stock in when we talk about these different facets of value on the basketball court, scoring, playmaking, etc. Yes, we can sort of chop them up at a high level to get an idea of, okay, if we need a really good isolation scoring piece on this team, what, you know, who can we fill in? What does the data say about that particular element? I talk about this in Thinking Basketball, the book. The way you construct a team in basketball at basically any level is, you don't think, I need a bunch of guys with great stats, or I need all the 6'10 players or whatever. You think, how can I put pieces together that complement each other and work? And that is to say, outside shooting, if you need or want post scoring or something like that, playmaking, guys who can handle the ball. And you do the same thing on defense. On defense, you might want a point of attack defender to get into quicker guards who can navigate screens and things like that to play pick and roll games, pick and roll defense. And then you might want wing defenders, and then you might want paint defenders, you know, guys who can play at the nail or protect the rim. So it's helpful to look at basketball from these high level concepts. But when we make a list like I'm about to, just keep in mind that the real challenge is completely decoupling the scoring and trying to isolate the scoring, no pun intended, trying to isolate the scoring from the other elements. So with that all said, what do I mean by scoring right out of the gate? To me, it's focusing on things like the ability to get to the basket off the dribble. From that, do you have a pull-up? Do you have a step back? Do you have a floater? Are you operating on ball out of pick and roll to try to create an advantage and get one of those shots off? What about your post game, either mid post or low post? And then there are other things that I think are less obvious to people, like your catch and shoot ability or your ability to cut and then blend that movement when you catch the ball. We think of this as off ball scoring, right? Quote unquote off ball scoring. So if I'm coming off a screen or I'm back cutting or something, how well do I finish then? Finishing in this case could be finishing at the rim, or it could be catch and shoot finishing. Or sometimes you use the screen off, like if it's a dribble handoff action, you're still using a screen or another player, but you're doing that in a way that gets you into your dribble or two and then your shot or your finish, something like that. Finishing at the rim, where you catch a lob, is a smaller component. I think putbacks, similarly, if you have some kind of paint ability or rim gravity when you're near the basket, someone throws up a miss and you're a great offensive rebounder. Well, in this case, if you're an offensive rebounder who can then finish by going back up because you're big, that is a component of scoring as well, but I think that's a lesser component. We'll get to that. We'll talk through all of this as we go through the players. So to begin with, I looked at a lot of three-year playoff runs. You may have seen that in my work before. You'll see it more in the future with any more historical stuff that comes out, but it's the idea of trying to get a larger sample size around a player's peak seasons in the playoffs. You play one or two opponents in a playoff run, and then you get eliminated. Not only are your scoring attempts low and your minutes played low, you've only played, you know, two different teams. So the idea behind this is to try to get a much larger, richer sample size where you play different opponents and, you know, you're less prone to having shooting luck. On a statistical level, that means we're looking at things like your scoring rate, your scoring efficiency, true shooting percentage, your free throw rate, your free throw percentage matters. It contributes to your efficiency, but you want to kind of think about how a guy scores because we're also thinking about how they're going to fit in or scale or you know, what happens when they go from being the primary option to having another guy who's sort of equally as skilled at that role, LeBron James by himself and Dwayne Wade by himself, versus putting the two of them together. Okay, with that out of the way, let me address one more thing while I'm here. I think most of you listening are familiar with this, but when I say scoring rate, I'm going to refer to points per 75 possessions. The per 75 possessions is just roughly how many possessions stars have played for the last few decades. So if you know you play 100 possessions in a game and you play 36 minutes, you play 75 possessions. That scoring rate you could do per possession, you could do per 100 possessions, per 75 possessions. It's all the same thing. You're just changing the unit. That's it. It's like inches and centimeters. It's all the same thing. So throughout this, I am actually going to reference an adjusted scoring rate when I talk about points or scoring volume. And because it's the playoffs, that's going to take into account the pace that the game was played at and the opponent's defensive strength. So these are just simple linear adjustments, but they help kind of try to make the numbers a little more apples to apples so people can get a better idea of what a guy was doing in a given circumstance. So for instance, if one player plays in a game with 90 possessions and another 110, you have the pace adjustment. But there's also the idea of if you play a defense that gives up 100 points, you know, it has a defensive rating of 100, so they give up 100 points every 100 possessions in the regular season, that defense you're less likely to score against. And so that we adjust for that in your relative true shooting percentage, and we make a similar adjustment in your volume because we know you're less likely to accrue points based on having less efficiency. These teams give up fewer points than if you play a defense that gives up 110 points every 100 possessions. So all of these numbers are going to be adjusted in that fashion. And then when it comes to scoring efficiency, and I have an article on this on BackPicks. I think it's a Patreon article from like end of 2019 that talks about incorporating turnovers, the idea of scoring turnovers, like if you're driving to the basket, you're trying to score, that we actually can, if we fold that into the idea of a scoring attempt, what does that do to your efficiency? So the efficiency that I'm going to reference here is going to be a kind of larger scoring efficiency than just your shots. And I guess for the purpose of the podcast, for simplicity, we can call it real scoring percentage instead of true shooting percentage. And the idea is real scoring percentage also estimates how many scoring turnovers you're committing. What's not a scoring turnover? A playmaking turnover, a passing turnover, the idea of a bad pass or, you know, maybe some turnover in the backcourt where you fumble it, something like that, versus I'm charging at someone and I get an offensive foul in the paint, or, you know, I'm driving down the lane and I get stripped or I travel, something like that. Okay, enough of laying out the groundwork. Let's get to the greatest scores ever. Okay, and this list is incredibly painful to go through. I hope I'm doing it justice, and I'll talk about the areas where I think it's really difficult. But as a community, what I see is people often just have this idea of like the greatest scores ever are the handful of highlight generators that you remember who can make amazing shots, have put up some big 50-point games or something like that, and have a variety of skills. And so this is going to skew first and foremost toward guards and wing players who can do this, and it's going to skew toward a handful of guys who, you know, love operating out of the mid post or very athletic, jumping over people. Hopefully we can go much, much deeper and more nuanced than that. Another thing that came up in researching this episode was the idea of think about these players. If you can do it, if you can force your brain to do it, think about these players. If everyone had the same kind of passing as a baseline, so you took away all the passing advantages of someone, you basically said, hey, what if everyone passed exactly like Reggie Miller? What if everyone, you know, wasn't going to be knifing people up with pocket passes and lobs and no looks and skip passes to the shooter once the guy takes one step in or something like that? What if we just cancel that from the equation, then start to think about these guys as offensive players? I don't know if that helps or makes it more confusing, but while you think about that, the first interesting list that kind of I looked at here was the number of unique three-season runs. That's 3 years. There could be a gap, so if you like miss a playoff season, that's okay. But the number of three-year runs where a guy averaged at least 27.7 adjusted points per 75. And now that sounds like just random. Why am I saying 27.7? That happened to be the top 100 scoring, you know, 3 year scoring runs ever. So you're thinking of a top 100 level scoring rate when you adjust for pace and when you adjust for opponent defensive quality. And then at least 5%, at least plus 5%. Real scoring percentage. So the scale is almost the exact same as true shooting percentage. So if you're in your head, you're thinking, you know, 55% is league average, 60% true shooting would be plus 5% true shooting. Same thing with the real scoring percentage concept. So plus 5%, it just includes your turnovers. Some players turn it over more and they're slightly hurt in this metric. Some players turn it over less and they're slightly helped. That's the idea. So let me run that mouthful back one more time. We're looking at top 100 seasons stretches by volume, and we're looking at least plus 5% efficiency as well. Okay. And you have to play 1,000 minutes. And if we do that, we get 14 guys in NBA history that have ever done this. This goes back to the shot clock, 1955. When I say NBA history, we're going back to 1955, the shot clock. 14 guys have done it. Maybe 13, because one just missed. No, it's 14. I can count. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar just missed because he only played 968 minutes from 1977 to 1979 with the Lakers when he got there pre-Magic. We'll talk a little bit more about that period of Kareem later on in the episode. The 14 guys to do this, Amari Stoudemire, 2005 to 2008. Remember, he missed the 2006 playoffs with a knee. Kawhi Leonard just did it, 2017 to 2019. Steph Curry did it from 2015 to 2017. He actually just missed, in a way, doing it twice. Just missed the cutoff from 2014 to... Well, he made the cutoff from 2014-2016 and then just missed the volume cutoff from 2017 to 2019, playing alongside Kevin Durant. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Where were we? Next guy to do it, Dirk Nowitzki, 2009 to 2012. He actually did it for four consecutive years there. Elgin Baylor, 1960 to 1963 with the Lakers, four consecutive years as well. Reggie Miller, 1992 to 1995, another four-year stretch. And then there's some guys that have done it more than once. Those guys are Hakeem Olajuwon. He hit this mark, so top 100 scoring volume over a three-year stretch, and at least plus 5% this overall efficiency in the scoring, the real scoring percentage. 1986 to 1988, he did it, and 1993 to 1996, a four-year stretch there when the Rockets were winning their championships. He did it twice. Kevin Durant did it twice. 2010 to 2014, that whole five-year stretch. Again, we're looking at unique stretches here, so I'm not double counting, but if you do it for, you know, more than three seasons in a row, we'll call that out. 2010 to 2014, Durant. 2017 to 2019, Durant. So he did it twice. Dwayne Wade did it twice. Dwayne Wade did it 2005 to 2007, the championship run with the Shaq team, and then 2009 to 2011, two of those years sort of more by himself with a cast of characters around him, and then the Heatles, of course, included at the back end of that. Jerry West did it two times, 1963 to 1965, and he did it from 1966 to 1968, although technically he didn't play in the 1967 playoffs, so that was a sort of a two-year stretch, make of that what you will. Kobe Bryant did it twice. Some of these guys doing it twice with the huge gaps are interesting. Kobe did it 2001 to 2003, and then again from 2006 to 2010. Again, that's like a five-year stretch on the backside. And then the three players in NBA history who have done this three times, and this is certainly foreshadowing guys I will have near the top of the list. LeBron James did it three times, three separate times, if we pull them out as unique runs, 2008 to 2011, 2012 to 2015, and 2016 to 2018. He basically does this every time he gets in the postseason, regardless of what happens or who his teammates are. Michael Jordan did it three times, 1986 to 1990. If you're wondering, the 86 to 88 period, the early Jordan, he just didn't have enough reps, didn't meet the minutes criteria. But if you fold in that whole stretch, 86 to 90, 91 to 93, the first three-peat, and then the second three-peat, 95 to 1998. Oh, and there's one more guy to do it. That's Shaquille O'Neal. He did it three times, 1996 to 1998. So you get the back end of Orlando. You get early Los Angeles, 99 to 01. And 2002 to 2004, I only split it up that way because you do get three unique three-year runs from Shaq. So, with those 14 guys in mind, let me just point something out. First, let me start with Amari, because I do think he's probably a name that may, you know, sneak up on you or surprise you a little bit. Amari was a fantastic scorer. Face up, you know, attack, face up and attack, a little post game, and then just an incredible pick and roll finisher, great lob finisher, lob gravity. I talked about this last week with Dave Dufour. He would be among my candidates for sort of greatest vertical finishers that we've seen in NBA history. And that matters. Like all that finishing that I talked about earlier, that matters, right? But I don't think it's as critical as when your offense is self-generated in this context of greatest scorers ever. So it matters, but it's not quite as valuable in this discussion. And the reason has to do with dependency. That's the key word here, dependency. So in the case of something like movement, off-ball scoring, catch and shoot, coming off screens or things like that, that may be off-ball. You're not self-generating that with the dribble, right? But the big difference, this is a huge, huge difference conceptually between depending on another player on your team to set you up for something and then coming off a screen and having basically anybody in the world being able to throw it to you because you're wide open. Because that is not dependent on a teammate's ability to draw defenders away from you or something like that. In fact, what we seem to see over the years is that players who rely on screens and movement can be harder to take away because, you know, if it's an isolation player and he's got to move, you can stick different defenders on him. You can, you know, famously the Spurs would put guys on Dirk Nowitzki or the Rockets would put guys on Dirk Nowitzki and try to get in him and under him early in his career. You know, if someone's vulnerable to strength, you can knock him off the block. If someone's vulnerable to length, you throw Tayshaun Prince on him or whatever. But guys who run around screens and use movement, much like wide receivers in football, it seems it's actually harder to naturally game plan or scheme them out of what they want to do. And the big difference and the reason why is dependency. So if you're Reggie Miller and you're flying off screens here, you still want, you know, you still want a teammate to pass you the ball. You're still going to have an assisted field goal. But so what? Any teammate can make those basic passes. The issue more has to do with being dependent on the skill of a teammate to set you up. In the case of Amari, he is quite dependent or was quite dependent on Nash for a lot of the easy bunnies, easy dunks, easy layups. And yes, there's a synergy in that Amari was so athletic crashing to the hoop that he would create an advantage himself in a way versus any other pick and roll partner in the league. But if you look at what happened with Amari when he went to New York after, you know, playing with Nash from 2005-2010, the efficiency predictably went down without all of those Nash created layups, and it went down significantly. You know, 5-7% is a massive, massive difference. In the case of this time period that we're looking at with Amari, 2005-2008. Well, if we look at that, there's some funkiness in the play-by-play, so I'm not sure about the exact number, but we are seeing the same kind of, like, you know, oh, hey, 6-8 percentage points are going off of your scoring efficiency when Nash goes to the bench. So there's an instance where we can look at the data and respect what Amari was doing as a scorer and as a finisher, but when we couch it in the context of this larger conversation, greatest scorers ever, and are you creating an advantage on the post and on the block and off screens and et cetera, I think Amari loses a lot of luster relative to the other mega giants we're gonna talk about in the names you've already heard. So who else did I say on that list? Actually, what happens if I make the list, the criteria for the list, a little tighter? What happens if we only look at guys who are, say, in the top 50 in volume? So that's at least 29 adjusted points per 75. And then what if we look at guys who only have, let's say, at least 6.5% scoring efficiency, plus 6.5%? Again, that's kind of a similar, we're kind of trying to, you know, look at top 50 or things like that. And if we do that, we lose some guys from the list. We have 10 other guys on that list besides Amari Stoudemire. We're left with Dwayne Wade. Now, he only did it once, 2009-2011. So you lose younger Wade when you increase the volume and the efficiency a little bit. Elgin Baylor is still there, 1960-1962. Kawhi's run is there. Durant only has the second run in Golden State, 2017 to 2019. West has the same four-year run, 1963 to 1966. Dirk has the same, again, it's the same like four-year run, 2009 to 2012. Reggie Miller has the same four-year run. Shaq does this twice, not three times. Jordan does this twice, not three times. You lose second three-peat Jordan, basically. And then LeBron James still does it three times. LeBron James still does it. LeBron James is good at basketball. Okay, I've gathered myself. Kobe drops off that list, but if we had, like, if we just brought it out just a shade more, we included a few more players, Kobe would get in that 2006 to 2009 stretch at plus 6 point. He's at plus 6.4 efficiency. That's what's doing it. And then that would also bring in Michael Jordan's second three-peat because the efficiency right around the same. So with that said, with that laid out there, let's start getting to some honorable mentions for me. Guys who I really, really, really considered, but I find it harder to make an argument to get them into the top 10, and we'll talk about some of the conceptual reasons why as we break these players down as scores. So the first category is lower volume, higher efficiency. Lower volume, higher efficiency. And relative to normal humans who have played in the NBA, these are still great volume scores. We would often describe them as volume scores because that's their trait, but relative to the super duper all-time greatest, you know, that list that we just looked at, their volume is clearly a notch or two below. And yet they do it on good teams with really high efficiency. So the guys in this category for me, Sam Jones, let's start with him, the old Celtic great. 1963 to 1966, Sam averaged, when you adjust the points per pace and all that stuff, averaged about 25 to 26 points per 75 adjusted. And then the efficiency, that again, that real scoring percentage concept, plus 10, plus 11 efficiency. Now we can only estimate turnovers. The turnover estimates are pretty good that I have before, you know, 1974. We're in the middle of the 60s. We can kind of cross-reference this with the team turnovers. But in general, he's pretty efficient. We know he's a pretty efficient scorer. Okay, another guy like this, Bob Pettit from the same period of time. Very similar kind of volume, you know, 25, maybe 25 points per 75, and then the efficiency plus 5. Another guy like this with the scoring around 25, Charles Barkley. He was actually up near 26 in Phoenix, plus 6 percentage efficiency. And then back when he was in Philadelphia, the volume was lower, the efficiency was higher. So it was like 24 and plus 9. We're talking about 1989 to 1991 for Barkley. Kevin McHale, maybe even a more extreme version of this, his volume was always down around 22, 23. But then the efficiency, I mean, it was crazy. 11% plus 12%, things like that. Now, let's start with McHale. McHale, incredible low post score. Obviously, the poo-poo platter of post-up moves, the potpourri of options down there, up and under, fade, Herman Munster stuff. Had a nice face-up shot, actually, later in his career. Could step out and hit threes occasionally, but he liked the face-up, really high release. Just incredible post moves. And here's the thing, though. When Larry Bird missed the 1989 season, McHale's volume didn't really go up. It stayed around the same, and the efficiency stayed around the same. And that basically signals to me that it's very unlikely McHale could have taken more shots without really denting his efficiency. When we think of that volume efficiency trade-off, we say, hey, I want you to be a number one guy. Now, to be a number one guy, you don't have to average 30, 35 points a game. We don't need that per se. But what we want is to build better and better offenses. And as we add better and better pieces to those offenses and complementary pieces, we want your thing to have value. And it seems to me the way McHale's thing has value, the way Barkley's scoring itself has value, maybe even someone like Bob Pettit, is that there's a certain volume they're comfortable getting their stuff in. If you think about Barkley, he didn't have an array of post moves. I talked about this on the Great Debates podcast with Nate Duncan. He had a lot of power, a lot of athleticism. He got a lot on putbacks, used his body really well with like basic drop step moves and things like that. But this wasn't a player like McHale who had a huge arsenal of up and under moves. And so Barkley is basically trying to find good shot selection for himself whenever he can. You know, the idea of being able to generate a high percentage shot on demand is really at the crux of a lot of this entire discussion when we say, who are the greatest scorers ever? Well, if you can make hard shots, that's nice, but usually those hard shots aren't super efficient, so you're giving up something. On the flip side, if you're really good at making easy shots, that's good too, but how often can you generate those easy shots? How reliable are they? It's kind of like the Amari dependency thing. When Amari's dependent on Nash, Nash gets him a lot of easy shots. When Nash goes off the court, most of those easy shots go away, regardless of who you play with. So this whole group of players, Sam Jones, Bob Pettit, Kevin McHale, Charles Barkley, fantastic statistical profiles when it comes to scoring, but the volume is lower, the efficiency is higher, and I'm not sure you can get much more out of them. And as a result, they fall below the guys ahead of them on this list, if you will. The next group of guys is kind of like big volume scorers who have some question marks. So now we're starting to get into the area where maybe volume matters less, you know, because again, just to circle back on this point, there is a trade-off between volume and efficiency with value. But if I'm looking at how easily you can generate high leverage, high value shots, how much pressure you put on the defense, and how much value that scoring arsenal itself has on better and better teams or different playoff scenarios, if you're kind of stuck at 22 points per game or something like that, 22 points per 75 possessions, even with really high efficiency, that's great. That has a certain amount of value, but does that have more offensive equity than a guy who can really, really pressure defenses constantly? I don't think it does, and so that's why I kind of put that first group in their own separate honorable mention category. The next category here, now we start to get into the area where you're going to have more comparable volume. Remember that cutoff list that I read a few minutes ago, talking about 27, 28, 29 points per 75. So if your scoring rate, for instance, George Gervin, his scoring rate was always around 30, 29 or 30, late 70s, early 80s, doing this without a three-point shot, by the way. And his efficiency was fantastic. He could shoot free throws. He could get to the line just about as much as your Kevin Durant's of the world and things like that. Actually, a very similar player to Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant just has a three-point line. He just plays in an era with more space. He plays in an era where, as his career has developed, he's learned reads like pick-and-roll reads, on-ball responsibilities, so his passing and playmaking has improved. This is not a holistic comparison between Gervin and Durant. I want to stay on their scoring, but the point here is that Gervin is a guy who, if you made this list and you want to put him in the, say, back of the top 10, I'm perfectly okay with that. This is a guy who I struggle with that same thought myself. The reason he's not there is really just because of sample size. It's because of the volume. He never has a sustained playoff stretch. So, you know, 700, 800 minutes, something like that. Couple seasons, 1978 to 1980. He's around, his scoring rate is around 30, and the efficiency around plus 6%, something like that. My scoring value metric thinks it's really valuable. So it's beautiful scoring. If you're not familiar with his game, loves coming off curls, screens, can play in that packed paint, you know, catch it at 17, turn and shoot, dribble, turn and shoot, get to the basket, lots of finger rolls, really, really skilled mid-range shooter. And he was about 6'8", maybe 6'9". He was tall. He was lanky. He was long. And so just a tremendous amount of success torching people, the kind of guy who, you know, when they were having the great legendary scoring title battle, I can't remember the season, but it's like David Thompson needs a certain number of points, Gervin needs a certain number of points. Oh, let's just feed it to George constantly and he'll throw up, you know, 50 or 60, something like that. So he was a scoring machine and very much lacked in other areas, and yet his scoring was so good that he was a great player. So like I said, I think he's got a really nice case for back of the top 10. I'm just a little concerned about the sample size. Next guy in this sort of honorable mention category with the question marks is James Harden. And James Harden has had some incredible regular seasons, but in the playoffs, as I've chronicled, I won't belabor it. I have a Great Debates shooting guard podcast involving a lot of this with James Harden, and I've mentioned it in other episodes as well. But just to put it in perspective, his best three-year run in the playoffs, obviously a good number of minutes and some different series against different opponents here, 2017 to 2019, just over a scoring rate of just over 30 and the efficiency plus 2%. So this is not great. If you want to try to get more efficiency at a lower volume, you can go back to his 2015 to 2017 period in Houston. The scoring rate is 28. The efficiency is plus 6. And here's the thing. I think Harden is a phenomenal scorer. I think in many ways he's one of the greatest scorers ever. But as I've discussed, all of these things where, you know, you don't get that extra foul, you're trying to draw that foul, or you know, you're used to kind of working the same switch or the same target over and over again, and teams respond, what happens is you start to lose a little efficiency. Now, he played with Chris Paul. Let's take the 2 years he played with Chris Paul in the playoffs. When Chris Paul was on the court, Harden's volume scoring was way down. His efficiency wasn't way up. So this is kind of part of the point, the scaling of your scoring game. It's like if I say, okay, James, you get to play with another maestro, or okay, James, you get to play with a good post player and another wing player. Are you going to still be able to give me 20, you know, a scoring rate of 27, 26 points a night, something like that, and then get that efficiency to like plus 10? I don't think that's how he operates because I don't think he has quite enough in his game to get there. I think he's one of the great players ever for extracting value from his game. But in this case, I think the value is just short. I would say the exact same thing about Karl Malone. Karl Malone, much like Harden, some of the greatest regular season scoring performances ever, single season, multi-year stretch, whatever, volume and efficiency combinations. But when you get to the playoffs, you kind of have a similar thing. So when Malone was a bit younger, 1992 to 1994, 1990 to 1992, whatever stretch you want to look at, early 90s Malone, very physically powerful, still had some stuff in transition. Basically, at this point in time, he was 20, let's say a scoring rate around 27, a little over 27, and the efficiency was plus 7%. This is a great season. This is a great set of seasons. I think he's a little bit unfairly knocked in the playoffs for falling apart with efficiency or being a choker, similar to Harden in the sense like sometimes people overstate these things. But in 1996, 1997, 1998, as the league slowed down, his rates went up. He moved his game away from the basket more toward the mid-range a little bit. Now you're talking about volume that's over 29 points per 75 when we adjust for pace, when we adjust for opponents, but that efficiency goes back down to plus 2. And it's too low for me, and it's too low for the reasons I've talked about before, where his, if you look at his profile, if you go to back picks and then click on top 40, you can find his top 40 profile. I talk about some of these limitations with being able to finish in traffic, being able to finish against bigger elite paint protecting defenses, things like that. Great jumper, face up game. But the other thing that happened there is you lose some of your transition scoring. And I think in this exercise, I again am going to devalue transition scoring just a touch, only because if you can't generate it, if you're dependent on something else, if it's an easy counter for the defense to say, okay, we're going to stop crashing the glass, or okay, we're going to sort of cross our T's and dot our I's more carefully because we know how this team gets out in transition, we're going to make sure we have our guards match up, or we're going to cross match however we want. If those are easier things to take away, then it has less carryover in the critical playoff rounds, and it's going to have less carryover when you try to build a championship team, when you say, all right, what happens if we put a second great scorer around this guy? What happens if we put an interior scorer and an off-ball scorer? Like, what do those numbers look like? Are we as excited about them? For me, the excitement that I want, and I think this comes from not just a theoretical place, but looking at the greatest offenses ever, looking at the empirical evidence on this. What I want is a guy who, when you put better players next to him, even if his volume goes down a little bit, the efficiency goes up and up and up and up, because they're not only really good at doing their normal stuff when needed, but they're really good at finishing the easier stuff that's been presented to them. That's the key interaction. I don't think Harden and Karl Malone have that. The last guy in this category for me, I think he's the last, yeah, last guy in this category was Elgin Baylor. Elgin Baylor is another guy who, if you said, Ben, he's number 8 for me, I would say, okay, I totally see the argument. Totally. I mean, this is tough. These guys are incredible. Not only that, but their numbers in certain ways are very similar. It's really about teasing out how the numbers came about and kind of thinking about, more than, thinking about the different contexts that they could play in versus just their single context. Elgin Baylor, I definitely see the case for. Elgin Baylor, 1960 to 1962, scoring rate of 29, plus 7% efficiency. The offenses weren't great. They were not very good in the regular season. They got better in the postseason. And so my question around his scoring is the same questions I have about him as a player that I've talked about before, which is, how much does this scale? When you actually bring Jerry West in and you give him more primacy and you let him do his thing, does Baylor's, what, again, this is the same point I was just making. You want Baylor's volume to go down a little bit or stay the same. I mean, it doesn't matter. But you want that to be a reflection of pressuring the defense and having easier and easier opportunities. So what you want is to put a guy like West next to Baylor and have West and his numbers and all that be successful so he can do his thing. But then the interaction of that gets Baylor more easy stuff for him. And so even if his volume goes down a little bit, his efficiency should go up. And that's not only is that not what happened in real life, really, but I don't think Baylor's game is made for that. Baylor had started to have knee injuries around this point in time, so I'm not going to completely hold him to that. But just the way he played in 1962, another thing is he was fantastic in transition. So if anything, his scoring rate as a reflection of how hard he pressured half-court defenses with his scoring arsenal could be a little overstated for the time. Another thing with him is he did make the 1,000-minute criteria here, but the sample size is a little small. He only played Detroit or St. Louis in every one of these playoff runs until the 1962 finals against the Celtics. Now, in the finals against the Celtics, he did set a record by scoring 61 points in a game, averaged 41 points per game in that series on good efficiency, so the man could score. One of the all-time greats. And a slasher, if you haven't seen him play, really good at attacking the basket for the time, getting kind of an angle from what the limited film that we have, getting that shoulder down and getting past someone, quick, athletic, vertical for his time, could finish at the rim. So fantastic score, just on the outside looking in for me here, though. Okay, last sort of category, and then we'll start to make our way through the list. Skill versus effectiveness. Skill versus effectiveness. This one, to me, is the old Earl Boykins versus Shaq argument. And I can't remember if I've brought it up a lot or ever on this particular podcast. So apologies if this is redundant. But the idea here is that Earl Boykins, if you don't know who Earl Boykins is, hit the YouTube or look him up. He's basically a 5'5" guard, one of the smallest players ever. Had success at Eastern Michigan, then had success making his way into the league as a backup, sometimes, you know, even a starter. Really, really skilled dribbling and shooting, like a highly skilled shooter. And so the fact that he was 5'5", had quickness, had handle, and had the accuracy of his shot and could play against everyone who was much bigger and do this at 5'5", was incredible. Absolutely incredible. In 2007, he started games in Denver. He started games in Milwaukee, averaged around 15 points a game, like, you know, 87% free throw shooter, this type of stuff. So if you think about, like, his skill for his size, he's one of the most skilled players ever. To be able to succeed with that physical package in the NBA is nothing short of miraculous. Then on the flip side, you have Shaq. Shaq is a good 7 feet, maybe a little bit longer. Insane wingspan. 300 pounds. Moves like he's 200 pounds. Just an absolute freak of an athlete. An incredible creation. Really just like nothing you've ever seen. And so can Shaq shoot like Earl Boykins? Can Shaq shoot 90% from the line? Can he make threes? Can he dribble the way Earl Boykins can dribble? Does he have, you know, the stop, start, the ability to fake and get these things off over bigger players? No, not even close. If he could, he'd be the greatest player ever. By such a landslide, we have to shut it down. But who was better? Of course, Shaq was better by a mile. And so the point is that we have this element of skill that we look at with players. Tough shot making, or the way he scored his point, you know, his bag, his arsenal. Does he score from three levels? Does he have all these fadeaways and up and unders? And can he dunk on people? And it's like, all that really matters is your effectiveness. The way you go about it matters in terms of how you fit with other players. And that's, to me, probably the most beautiful part of basketball. But when it comes to just an individual, your effectiveness is the thing that matters, not necessarily your skill. So Shaq didn't have all those moves, but he was bigger than everyone. And in basketball, that makes him the best. This applies to Hakeem Olajuwon. Hakeem Olajuwon is going to be an honorable mention here. For me, I think it's harder to make an argument to get him in the top 10, although I understand if you do it. Of course, 1986 to 1988, he was a scoring rate of about 28 plus 9% efficiency. He had these moves, the moves you know of, the dream shake, the fadeaway, all that stuff. 1993 to 1995, scoring rate of 29, efficiency plus 5%. By the way, all of these stats are available to Patreons. You sign up at patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. And you, I think as an insider, you will basically get access to a database that has all kinds of scoring stats like this that I'm going to reference throughout. So Hakeem, just incredibly skilled scorer. The hardest shots you could imagine for a center, face up, spin, pivot, hook back, falling out of bounds. And he made these, but it's taking shots that or generating shots at will that aren't super high efficiency, but are somewhat high efficiency. I don't think Hakeem is a great score for fitting and scaling. And I've talked about this before. I hold him in very high regard historically, but this has always been the question mark for me. And specifically his scoring game. You know, if you put him with Drexler in his prime instead of Drexler in 95 or something like that, if you put him with another guy or two other guys, what happens to that scoring volume? It's really, really good, but I think relative to the guys ahead of him, it's just a little bit on the outside looking in. Two more. Let's see what we're doing here with this list. Couple more honorable mentions, I guess, in this same concept of effectiveness. And this is a player I've talked about extensively, probably more than anyone else has, and that's Reggie Miller. Reggie Miller, and I can see the case and the argument for him being in the top 10. And if there's one thing I want you to take away from this, it's that Reggie Miller was a crazy good scorer. How good? How good, you ask? Okay. I'm glad you asked. You may have noticed that he made the cutoff earlier when we did those 14 players. He made the cutoff when we increased the volume. That's right. 1993 to 1995, 29.5 points per 75 adjusted for opponent, adjusted for pace. The efficiency, plus 12%. Now, when Miller was older, 1998 to 2000, that's when they made the run to the finals. They played the Bulls, the Eastern Conference Finals each season. Now we have a larger sample size. He's an older player. It's a slightly different team. The scoring rate was only 25, the efficiency plus 11%. I think you're talking about one of the greatest second or third fiddle scorers ever. I think about you're talking about one of the greatest scalers ever in terms of scoring and being able to finish easier and easier opportunities, being able to fit with other players by running around and creating havoc off ball. But I am not convinced that if you need a guy to be in this upper echelon of volume that we're largely dealing, get me 28, get me 30, get me 32, self-generate, do it against different now, he's very resilient against the great defenses. But to get to that volume against great defenses over and over, I have more question marks about him. For instance, the 1993 to 1995 stretch, even though it's a three-year playoff stretch, even though he plays, whatever it is, 1,400 minutes or something like that, it's still a hot shooting stretch. He still is about 43% in the playoffs. That's a little, you know, he's a little over his head there, more like 40, 41% typically. And if you, you know, kind of do the Jacob Goldstein adjust for luck and you say, well, what does it look like if he's only at 41%? I think you're probably getting a more realistic take on the fact that his volume was going to be best case scenario, like 27 points per 75 or something like that. Maybe the, you know, 29.5 on plus 12% efficiency, you know, you can make kind of a statistical argument that this is one of the greatest scoring seasons ever. And if you remember the original podcast, the debut Thinking Basketball podcast, I talk about that, the statistical difference between him in the regular season and the playoffs from one perspective. I think I had him in the top five in the playoffs just looking at those numbers. So again, this is a guy, understand, if you have him in the top 10, I can see an argument for him being maybe as high as six or seven, but to me, these question marks around the hot shooting, where the volume really stands. One more little quirk about that, even though they're very good defenses, he did repeatedly play Atlanta, Orlando, and New York over and over again in those three seasons. Atlanta, Orlando, and New York. Those poor teams, they had to get the Miller treatment. But I will say, even with those things in mind, this is the place he should be in this discussion. Like, we should really step back and appreciate the volume of points that he was putting up against these teams at this pace and the absurd efficiency. Now, where's that efficiency come from? This is where I said free throws matter. Miller drew a lot of fouls. He drew fouls like George Gervin and Kevin Durant, and then he's over 90% from the line. Then, of course, the three-point shooting. As a finisher, as a guy coming off screens, like, we won't get into gravity per se here, but this is what Miller was doing. So very hard to defend him. You know, I think if you want to have him higher, I understand it. But the key takeaway should be he was an absolutely incredible scorer. Okay. Top 10. Here we go. What are we? How far are we in this? 50-something minutes. Woo. Fortunately, I've talked a lot about these guys, but hey, this is a special episode number 50, so we're just going to keep going. Number 10 for me came down to, well, there's a lot of guys I considered, but the hair splitting at the end came down to one more honorable mention and number 10, and I could go either way here. I kind of wanted to talk about them together before I get to the final nine guys. On one hand, it's Kawhi Leonard. And on the other hand is Steph Curry. Now, I think if I'm forced to pick, I'd probably take Steph Curry. But let's talk about this. Kawhi Leonard, just so we can put it in perspective, Kawhi Leonard's stats in the 2017 playoffs and the 2019 playoffs, 1,700 minutes, just over 29 points per 75. That's the adjusted rate. And that real scoring percentage, that efficiency, is plus 9%. He's a relatively low turnover player. And we probably all have a feel for how he does it, how efficient he is, uses his body, both with the pull-up, the three-point shooting, that mid-range where he can just get to wherever he wants and kind of create space and hover, and then big enough to bang to get all the way to the basket if he gets an edge or finish among the trees. Truly a phenomenal score. I mean, anyone we're talking about with a top 10, top 15 scoring peak in NBA history, as we are right now in this podcast, right now, clearly an absolutely phenomenal, incredible score. Let's contrast that to Curry. Curry's stats from 2015 to 2017, just under 29 points per 75, and the efficiency plus 8%. So, like, apples to apples, just without any context, without any further drilling down, the numbers are very, very similar, very slight edge to Kawhi Leonard there. One of the reasons, one of the issues, one, Curry's injuries in 2016, and then again an injury in 2018 in the postseason, throwing him off a little bit. But two, and I think some of it is the injury in 2016, some of it might just be other factors, his turnovers have gone way up in some of those postseasons. So he's actually losing efficiency ground when we bake in the turnovers. In the regular season, not a big problem. In the playoffs, the turnovers are going up a little bit more. So in 2015 itself, when he was healthy, to me this is before like that pure peak, that 2016 season when he went even further, started shooting it from wherever he wanted, whenever he wanted. Finally, you know, that was kind of his final form, if you will. He, in 2015, the year before that, scoring rate around 29, efficiency plus 8%, so very similar to the averages I just laid out. And then in 2017, scoring rate just over 29, and the efficiency was plus 11%. That's the kind of ideal season that I'm looking for when you play on a super high-level elite offense. In that case, arguably the greatest offense of all time, probably the greatest offense of all time. And so you can put other guys in place, and you're never really going to play next to Steph Curry, no matter who you put on the court or how many great players, and have his volume get very low. It's just never going to happen. I don't even know what the floor is, 25, 26, something like that. And to be able to be in the range, 25, 27, 29, 30 points per 75, and have the efficiency plus 8, plus 10, plus 12. I mean, he probably has the greatest single season scoring year in NBA history in 2016 in the regular season before the injury. The numbers on that, by the way, 32 points per 75, plus 13% efficiency. And that was more, you know, that was not with Durant. That was really with kind of Klay Thompson as your second offensive guy, and then a few other nice skilled parts on that team. So I think you can go either way here with Curry. I think from one perspective, you can be slightly lower on the scoring. From another perspective, you can be slightly higher. You know, question marks around the injuries. How much do you count those injuries? Things like that. But this is kind of where I've settled on him. And again, if I had to pick, I would probably pick to put him as my number 10. I can definitely see an argument for him and maybe even Kawhi a few spots higher. Although once you start to get to the top four or top five, you'll see the arguments become a little bit harder to crack into for some of these guys. But in the case of Curry, the last thing that would flip me in this direction was in the 2019 playoffs without Kevin Durant on the court. So this is 500 minutes without Kevin Durant on the court. Curry was a scoring rate of just under 31 and a true shooting percentage that was about plus 7. So if you're thinking, can you carry a heavier load with him? Does your efficiency completely crater? Is he like Kevin McHale? Is he never going to carry a heavier load? I think there's enough evidence that you can be in this super duper all-time top five range the way he plays with relatively high efficiency. There's also some question marks there, and I think those question marks are valid, especially when it comes to the players in the top five or six on this list. But again, remember this category that I segued into here. The idea behind this category was skill versus effectiveness. So we know Curry has tremendous skill when it comes to ball handling, when it comes to shooting, but I think a lot of people think, oh, if I need a bucket at the end of a game and I throw it in to Kawhi, I can easily in my brain see how he's going to take the dribble left, he's going to pound it into you, he's going to put your shoulder into you, he's going to call for the screen and get the little pull up and create that space that he does. And there's a bunch of guys in our heads that we can think about that way. With Curry, maybe he's going to try to dance around and get a three off against Kevin Love. And I think that's an unfair mental representation. One, I don't think he was healthy in that play at the end of the 2016 Finals Game 7 against Love that I just referenced. But two, if you also look at how many big shots he's made, his ability to cut without the ball and get to a spot, he did it against Houston. He did it in the Raptors series at the end of Game 5. He's really, really good in the mid-range. So when he upfakes you and gets by, he scores in the mid-range. And then he's a really good finisher at the rim. One of those reasons that he's, you know, got nice rim finishing numbers isn't because he's as good as Kawhi Leonard once he gets downhill against traffic. It's because he's selective in knowing when to go to the floater, when to go to the scoop, how to create space, how to get to the line, or pass. So he doesn't force a huge amount of low percentage shots. And so Curry is very much a guy who is hunting high value shots, high bang for their buck shots, and he's able to hunt them well. Does that mean that at the end of a game, I want to throw it to him and clear out in isolation? No, but when you look at the effectiveness and the totality of the scoring and you add in how scalable it is, I think a spot in the top 10 is certainly warranted. Let's look at the top 9 guys, and I will try to power through these using all the concepts that we've built upon in the first hour here. Man, an hour. I'm sorry. I'm already tired of listening to myself talk. I can only imagine where you are. Let's get through it. Number 9 for me, 9 and 8, or even 9, 8, 7, just very tricky to rank or order. I can go in any order here. Number 9, I landed on Dwayne Wade, and number 8, Kobe Bryant. 2009 to 2011, Wade is a scoring rate of 30 plus 6.5% efficiency. 2007 to 2009, Kobe Bryant, scoring rate of about 30.5% plus 6.5% efficiency. Incredibly, incredibly similar. I think if I had to choose, kind of the same reasoning around Curry, I like the way Kobe's game scales a little bit better. I've talked about this before. I think he's a better off-ball scorer than Dwayne Wade. Wade might be better with his scoring at carrying a team in certain situations because his ability to get to the rim, his ability to draw fouls, put pressure on the rim, that first step. You know, this is his 2009 to 2011 stretch I just cited, but even what he was doing in the 2005 and 2006 playoffs against the Pistons and against the Mavs, I mean, one of the greatest first steps in NBA history, and then physically strong enough to take contact or finish at the rim. Kobe, probably the greatest, if not one of the greatest, the greatest tough shot makers in NBA history. But again, this is that skill effectiveness concept where I think you're talking about Hakeem's ability to take and generate these lower efficiency shots on command, and those are the things we remember, but the totality of the effectiveness isn't quite there. In Kobe's case, I think he's better at almost everything scoring-wise that you'd want Hakeem, you know, if you say, okay, here's Hakeem and Hakeem's in my top 15 and I'm considering him and he's got the shot making and he draws a certain amount of fouls and, you know, catch and shoot and off ball stuff, I think Kobe's probably a little bit better across the board. Done it in different contexts, done it next to Shaq and then next to Pau Gasol. And so I give the edge to Kobe in that case. Number seven is Kevin Durant for me. And I can see the argument for him a spot or two higher, maybe. I can also see an argument for picking some of the other guys we've mentioned over him in this top 10. He was actually tougher to place than I thought he would be. He's very similar to George Gervin, as I mentioned, but instead of the two-level scoring, the three-level scoring, great three-point shooter. Again, I like the fact that he's got off-ball movement mixed with the mid-post game, mixed with the isolation game, so he can finish stuff, he can fit, he scales, and that's probably the deciding factor here for me. But his 2017-2019 in Golden State, just under 30 points per 75, that adjusted points per 75, and then the efficiency right up near plus 10% efficiency. I think there's a little recency bias where people look at that and they say Kevin Durant's the greatest scorer ever, things like that. I think you can make a pretty, pretty strong case for the guys ahead of him, starting with number six, Jerry West. Now, this is a trickier one because it's from a different era. But in West's case, you know, for his era, had a tremendous handle, could pull up or go left or right, which was rare at the time. Very quick release, incredible range. I mean, probably would have been proficient if they just slapped a three-point line on the court right in 1965 because he's shooting from 23, 26 feet sometimes, and just poured in points, catch and shoot. He moved a little. He was quick with his decision-making. He could get to the elbow. He could face up. He could get to the basket. Legendary for all the injuries he had going to the hoop. Could get out in transition and finish in transition going to the hoop, but that allowed him to generate free throws, very high percentage free throw shooter, yada, yada. So this is a guy I think in modern parlance belongs in this group because he's got some similarities with, you know, a guy like Kobe in terms of relative to era and the scoring arsenal, similar maybe to Wade in some ways as well. But really with any of these guys, you know, you could pick the order and I'm not going to quibble. Number five, boy, this was another incredibly difficult one. Just to sort of clarify my confidence in ranking versus laying out the case here. I think any of these guys you could probably have a little bit higher, and a bunch of these guys you could have much lower, and you could swap in some of the other guys we talked about earlier. You know, you could have a guy having honorable mentions as high as six or seven, and maybe the five guy back at nine. You could also have this next guy even higher, depending on how you slice it, and that's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar at number five. I really struggled with where the heck to place him. From 1977 to 1979, he doesn't even get 1,000, just gets under 1,000 minutes, which is why he doesn't make that cutoff. 28 points per 75, adjusted for pace, adjusted for opponent, plus 12% scoring efficiency. That is bonkers. That actually generated the highest scoring value in the metric that the new version of that metric that I put together. I'm not exactly sure why. He looks at team, you know, team strength and who your teammates were. It's possible that it's basically saying, whoa, when we look at those Lakers teams and the rosters weren't constructed very well. I talk about this in Kareem's profile on Backpicks Top 40. It's like when you look at all that and you still look at his scoring and you still look at his self-generated scoring, it is absolutely incredible. The other thing with Kareem for me is I do a little mental curving for the pace adjustment for big men. Wilt had this as well, where, you know, if you're looking at Wilt's scoring, wait a second, Wilt Chamberlain, I failed to mention Will Chamberlain. Will Chamberlain is another one of those guys. I'll come back to Kareem in a second here. But let's talk about Wilt and Kareem together. Wilt is another one of those guys who, to me, is just like I ended up having him in that honorable mention group just on the outside looking in. I think you can probably make some case that he belongs in the top 10. And I've written many, many, many words about Wilt, so I won't go too deep here. But if we look at his stats from 1962 to 1964, the volume scoring years, adjusted scoring rate is 26, and the efficiency is plus 7. So that is lower by sort of a full click than what we're dealing with here on most of these players. But just like with Kareem, I do think there's some mental curving that needs to take place because the pace adjustment isn't apples to apples for every player. And when you have a big man who plays in a transition system or plays in a day where the game is very quick and up tempo, you are looking at their scoring only on the possessions that they run up into the front court. These guys aren't really scoring in transition, so the pace adjustment is watering down their scoring just a touch. However, in the case of Wilt Chamberlain, I just want to point something out. Those offenses in the early 1960s, when he was doing his volume scoring, weren't very good, and they weren't very good in the playoffs. They're actually problematic in the playoffs. And this might sound crazy because he's famous for scoring, averaging 50 points in a season in 1962, 50 points per game in a season. But I imagine some of those teams could have actually used more scoring from him, more effective scoring from him. And I'm not saying they should have kept throwing him the ball. I'm saying you actually wanted a more skilled scorer, in my opinion. Or, I mean, in theory, you just want a better playmaker and overall basketball player. But here's why I say this. Because his per 30, if we just look at a basic per 36 scoring, he averaged 33 points per 36 in the regular season from 1962 to 1964. That's a huge number. But this number goes down to just over 26, 26 and a half in the playoffs, in the 1962 and 1964 playoffs. So his playoff scoring volume, even if we don't consider something like pace, his playoff scoring volume was not this absurd, ridiculous, cartoonish volume. That was never the case. And in the playoffs, in more winning settings, or in situations against better defenses, he was never able to do that. Now, some of this might be Bill Russell, so I understand if you want to, your mileage varies a little bit, you want to curve it differently in your head and things like that. I get that. But in this case, he's certainly statistically not in the same group, and I'm not sure, looking at his game, you know, he likes that fadeaway instead of power moves. It's like a lesser version of Shaq. The free throw shooting is a big deal as well. You know, never being able to convert all those fouls into high percentage offense because your free throws are stuck in the 50s or something like that. That matters to me here. And I think that matters if we scale a player up or put him on different teams. And of course, as we know with Wilt, later on when he scaled up, that volume scoring went way, way, way down. And to me, it's not damning, but that is, yes, another indicator that the skill set and the way and the type of volume scoring that he provided even earlier in his career wasn't this incredibly filthy, robust, diverse thing that either carried okay offenses to really good heights or fit really well when taking good offenses to great heights. Kareem, on the other hand, that sky hook is so unstoppable. And so when you start mentally curving Kareem's numbers, you're like, wait a second here. This guy with the efficiency, his post game, what he's able to do to people, can anyone really? I mean, Moses Malone's strength famously gave him some issues, but this is also in like his 13th season. You know, we're talking peak 1977, 78, 79, 80, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I don't know. The guy, I don't think he's a guy who goes for 50. I think he is a guy who just constantly gets you the points you need to get in the half court at the efficiency you need to get. And taking the same point I made about Wilt, if anything, I'm a little bit more confident in Kareem's general scoring arsenal, because 8 years later, when he was an old man, he was still torching people with it. Okay, let's do the top four. I only feel comfortable about number one, by the way, but I think these are the right, in the spirit of this exercise, I think these are the right guys to leave at the top for you to think about. Number four is Shaquille O'Neal. And this to me is like a better version of Wilt all around. More like his numbers, 2000 to 2002 in the playoffs, his volume is near 32 points per 75, that adjusted scoring rate. His efficiency up near plus 8, plus 7.5%. His turnovers are relatively low. The scoring value metric likes him. Like, statistically, it's incredible. Now, how much of that do you want to, you know, adjust for things like putbacks, or, you know, maybe you like the fact that Shaq has rim gravity and lob gravity and things like that? I think all those things matter. Does it matter that you can't really play like five out or have like a heavy movement system because his scoring really relies on parking himself in the lane, or, you know, cutting across the paint, or setting up in the mid post near, you know, the elbow or something like that? And that's even a little bit too far out for him, maybe. That's a fair question. And I think just like with Wilt, the free throw shooting. I think if he had, you know, if Shaq shot 70% from the line instead of 55%, you're talking about an increase in volume, a point or two or something like that, and an increase in efficiency. And I think you'd probably have a case for the greatest score ever, a stronger case, maybe I should say, for the greatest score ever. On the flip side, I did struggle immensely with Shaq versus Kobe. And Shaq here is at number four, and Kobe is at number eight. Two totally different types of scorers. One probably scales a little bit better just as a scorer. One probably a little bit better in terms of, you know, I need a bucket, on ball kind of scoring in certain situations. I think Kobe has the edge there. So, you know, I don't know. I think you can... This thing is so fluid, depending on how you want to construct this, that even though I had Kobe in that group with Wade and Durant, I think there's some great conversations to be had there. Now you have, you know, the number seven, the number eight guy versus the number four guy. They were teammates. I'm not sure who I think I would lean Shaq. That's why I have him higher. But the point is, I can see a really, really good argument for Kobe, and I had them in my notes prepping this and laying this out, sitting next to each other. But the fact that Shaq has, I mean, just the statistical rare air he's in from the late 90s to 2003, 2004, everything he's able to do, the pressure he puts on defenses, the fact that he seems basically indefensible, he fouls out front lines, they shifted the whole league to try to deal with just his scoring, right? It's not his playmaking. It's not even his offensive rebounding per se, although that's a component. And I think depending on what kind of credit you want to give his offensive rebounding, you could dial him up a little bit higher on this list or bring him back to the back of the top 10 or something like that. But just an absolute machine, just a monster. Number three, I went with Dirk Nowitzki. 2009 to 2011, about 1,500 playoff minutes. Guy averages 30 points per 75 and on plus 10% efficiency. That is absolutely absurd. Very, very, very few people in NBA history can touch that. So he's kind of in the right volume club. You know, maybe there's another gear, 32, 33, with Shaq and the two guys in front of Dirk. I don't know. You know, you got to think about context. Dirk has played with other players who were very skilled offensively at different points in his career, but he's always been allowed to be the number one focal point. But if he weren't, he strikes me as a guy whose volume could come down a touch, but his efficiency would remain very high. Such a skilled shooter. can finish plays off ball, both popping off of little screens from 16 feet, that kind of action, or catch and shoot three-pointers, which weren't super encouraged a decade ago, but, you know, his volume could even be higher today or in settings like that where that's encouraged more. And the thing with Dirk to me that I ended up just feeling more comfortable with him at the sort of front of the rest of this group is that robustness of his game, the strength that he puts in, the one-legged step back, the up and under, the mid-post, the go to the office, the fact that if you still put the wrong size players on him, he's too quick for him, the 90-something percent free throw shooting, the great three-point shooting. It's like Dirk Nowitzki never became a great passer. Dirk Nowitzki never became a great offensive rebounder. He was spectacular because his scoring game was so damn difficult to handle. Number two, LeBron James. I mean, people don't realize how good LeBron James is just as a scorer. From 2012 to 2014, adjusted scoring rate of 30.4, efficiency just under 10%. So very, very similar statistically to Dirk. And that's, of course, playing alongside Wade, alongside, but you know the team construction. But 2008 to 2010, the first two MVP years, the year before that, scoring rate was 32.5. Very, very, very rare to get into that level of scoring rate. And then the efficiency, +7.5. So what that says is you can keep putting pressure on defenses. You can keep dialing up. And that has applications that may not automatically scale, right? That may not automatically play well next to other great offensive players to try to make an incredibly all-time great offense. But that's a starting point that is really, really strong. Now, one more thing here on LeBron. When he played without Wade in Miami, when Wade was off the court from 2012 to 2014, to give you an idea of how good of a scorer he was, he still had the drive. His jump shot had come around. Mid to long twos, three-point shooting, went from a below-average guy in that area to above-average as a three-point shooter. Could do it off of catch and shoot a little bit, became more comfortable pulling up, or if you go under a screen, shooting a three that way. Obviously, you know, the greatest transition scorer in league history. One of the greatest rim finishers in league history. Then starting in 2012, he adds the post game where, go back to the idea of effectiveness versus skill. He's not Hakeem Olajuwon in the post. He doesn't have all these moves, but he knows how to use his power. He starts to become comfortable playing back to the basket or catching deep and turning and facing that little bank shot off the glass or power dribble, get to the bucket, get to the free throw line. The whole thing, 2012 to 2014, when Dwayne Wade was on the bench in the playoffs, LeBron James averaged just under 34 points per 75. That's unadjusted for opponent, 34 points per 75. His efficiency, true shooting percentage, +8%. When Wade's in there, it's 26 and +9. When Wade's off, it's 34 and +8. So these huge, gouty scoring numbers you're seeing are largely coming not from fitting with Wade, but I'm just so damn good at scoring that when more stuff has to run through me, my volume, my efficiency barely goes down, but I can handle a volume that's otherworldly. I hope walking through this from the low volume, high efficiency guys to these guys kind of puts into perspective the different layers. Because for me, it's not literally about the number, whether it's efficiency or volume. It's about what that number says as a reflection of your skill, as a reflection of the pressure you put on a defense, and as a reflection of your ability to get high-value shots on command. And we all know who number one is because, along with Shaq, you can probably make the argument that he was the greatest player ever at getting those high-value shots on command, and that's Michael Jordan. His volume from 1991 to 1993 was 35 points per 75. That's the adjusted rate. Plus 8% efficiency. 1989 to 1991, 34 plus 10%. 1989 to 1991, 34 plus 10%. So Kevin McHale, 22 points plus 12%, something like that. Then you go to the next layer or whatever. You go to Sam Jones or Charles Barkley, and maybe you can get 25 at plus 8, plus 10%. It's probably a group of guys at 28. You can get a little over 30 and get to 31. When you get up to 33, 34, 35 points per 75, and your efficiency is still, you know, it's one thing to be league average. It's one thing to be slightly above league average. Allen Iverson, Carmelo Anthony, Dominique Wilkins. You know, these are great scorers. These are really skilled players that have value in certain applications. Sometimes they can't fit or scale as well, and so I don't care for them as much. But, you know, you're still talking about guys who are all-stars, all NBA players, just because of their scoring. Then there's another gear, 33, 34, 35, and the efficiency that still comes with that. Because in Jordan's case, arguably the greatest first step ever, as quick as possibly could be, converting that first step off a dribble or two into a pull-up, and then the hang time and the elevation and the high release. And so he's constantly getting relatively easy shots for him from 18, 16, 14, 13. If he gets the full step and he gets to the basket, I mean, he didn't even play in an era with great spacing, but his ability to finish at the rim or understand how to use his body as a shield and take contact. You know, you think about him as a two-footed leaper going in sideways with the tongue out. That acts as a shield. When he gets a step and he gets down the lane, it is very hard to just completely erase him. And so between the mid-range stuff, between the basket finishing, the fact that he was an 84% free throw shooter, all these things, whew, yeah. I think his off-ball game is underrated. Had a lot of movement off-ball coming off screens. Really quick decision-maker at times, which I like. Comfortable with him at number one. Not really comfortable with much else in the list. Hopefully you've been comfortable with this exercise. If you want to get more comfortable with Thinking Basketball content, head on over to Patreon, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. You can check out podcast post shows, the articles on Backpicks, the data from podcasts like this, so on and so forth, especially now in these days, if you can. The support is incredibly appreciated. Another thing to support this podcast that you can do is wherever you listen, Stitcher, Apple, wherever, leave a rating, leave a review, hopefully a good one. That is super well appreciated. Ooh, that's it. This was a long one. Let me know what you think on Twitter. Really, really difficult to sort out some of these players, but hopefully I got the all-time greats kind of in the right ballpark where they need to be and did them justice and gave you some food for thought. That is it for me. I will talk to you in the next episode. And of course, as always, I hope you are having a great day.